This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. One guest this week, but an excellent one. Paul Feinbaum is the host of the aptly named The Paul Feinbaum Show. That can be heard on ESPN Radio, SEC Network, Sirius XM Channel 81 from Monday to Friday from 3 to 7 p.m. And I took in his show, obviously, in the days after Saban retired, and it was fascinating radio. Especially for me, you know, someone who grew up in New York. It's really interesting and it's entertaining. And when a big story in the SEC happens, I cannot recommend Feinbaum's show enough. I mean, really any big story in college football, I would say. And so we discuss all sorts of things regarding Nick Saban, including the prospect of him working at ESPN, which both Paul and I think is essentially a fait accompli. So about 40 minutes with Paul Feinbaum. We're also going to have a couple clips of some of the greatest calls from his show. And as I have written before, Phyllis from MOGA, Phyllis Perkins, the late Phyllis Perkins, I think has the greatest sports talk call of all time. And we'll play that for you as well in case you have not heard it. So Paul Feinbaum of ESPN coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, really a gentleman does not need any introduction. I'll give him one here. Paul Feinbaum hosts the aptly named The Paul Feinbaum Show, which can be heard on ESPN Radio, the SEC Network simulcast, Sirius XM Channel 81, as well as affiliates, radio affiliates around the South, Monday through Friday, 3 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time. His show, of course, is sort of, I would say, the record when it comes to SEC football. In addition to hosting the Paul Feinbaum Show, he's a commentator on SEC Nation, appears on many, many ESPN platforms, First Take, Get Up, SportsCenter, College Football Live, etc. Also a New York Times best-selling author, and now he's here on this low-budget podcast, and we appreciate him coming on. Welcome, Paul Feinbaum.
It is my pleasure. I feel like Jim Miller must not have been available this week. So thanks for the call.
Yeah, I've used, you know, I have an allotment, like a cash allotment for Jim Miller, and it's already over by January 15th, Paul. I'm gonna bring him back in 2024 for whatever happens at ESPN. All right. So here's what the reason I want you to come on, and I mean you'd be a great guest at any time, but I'm so fascinated by Nick Saban retiring. Because it's so impactful in one part of the country, your part of the country, but definitely not as impactful like where I grew up in New York. And so let's sort of start here. How did your callers react to him stepping away? Because there won't be a bigger coach stepping away in our lifetime for your audience.
It was a shock, Richard, even though it probably shouldn't have been. Because I'm a little too close to the sun. I have the fortune of or misfortune of being old enough to have covered the end of Paul Bryant. So I've seen this before. A lot of younger callers just simply couldn't handle it. It was overwhelming. And I had to remind myself sometimes that we were talking about someone who was alive and healthy at 72, as opposed to had passed away. And I had a friend. The story broke on Wednesday afternoon, and I'll go through that in a second. But I had a friend later on, a physician who's actually a friend of my wife's, who texted me that night saying, are you okay? I watched you and you seemed distraught. You seemed, I'm just concerned about your health. I said, I'm fine. I promise you everything is okay. This is what we do. But it was that kind of tone. And it was expected. I mean, this guy has done it all. And I brought up Coach Bryant a minute ago, Richard, because I'll never forget on December 15th, 1982. Yeah, you do remember these things. Walking out of the press conference in Tuscaloosa as a 26-year-old reporter, kind of going outside to catch my breath for a second because I was in a deep state of shock and depression that the biggest story of my life had just ended before my career had even reached 30, and I thought I would never cover anything bigger. And then here I was last Wednesday afternoon doing the same thing about the same school and someone who will likely be regarded as a better coach, if that's even possible.
Wow. When Paul Bear Bryant retired, where were you working? Where were you writing? Who were you writing for?
I was a reporter for the Birmingham Post-Herald. So that was my beat. And the story broke late on a Tuesday night. I had taken a few days off. The season was over and you were trying to catch your breath. And I got a call. So I ran down this sounds crazy now, but you've worked for news. I ran down to the newspaper about 10 o'clock at night. And Richard, it's a night that's just really in embedded in my mind. I called Coach Bryant's house. I mean, that's how things have changed, where you could never do that now. I got a hold of his wife, Mary Harmon Bryant, and I said, we're reporting. She said, well, I don't know if that's true or not. Coach is out recruiting. I said, well, you might want to correct me. She said, well, just do what you think is best. So we broke the story. It was, as you can imagine, six columns across the top of the front page, and the whole city in shock. But what was interesting about that, he the retirement was on the 15th. I'm not going to get too deep into stories. I got a call that night about 11:30 from Joseph Vecchione, who was the executive sports editor of the New York Times. And he said, what do you got? I said, well, I figured I better be nice to this guy. Maybe he'll hire me one day. I said, well, we're reporting that Bryant is stepping down and that Ray Perkins, the head coach of the New York Giants, is taking his place. And he goes, no blanking way. He said, you're out of your mind. I said, I don't know, Joe. I really felt pretty comfortable with this story. And of course, the next morning he called me and asked me if I could string for him the press conference announcing Perkins.
I love that. Wow, 26, man. That's a lot of pressure on a 26-year-old to write that piece. I will get to Kellen DeBoer in a second, but the I listened to some of your shows after Saban retired, and the tenor was like a state funeral in many ways. I would say, like, in terms of the callers, it was great and entertaining, especially for someone who's not part of this world. But would you describe it as that, like more sadness than I don't know, like less like thanks for the journey and more, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening.
Yeah, I'll offer this. I don't want to act like I knew it was going to happen, but I was prepared because I've been following the story very closely. And I'd seen Nick Saban a couple of times this year. And every time it just seemed a little bit different. Now, I got a call. I don't mean to go into long, drawn out stories, but I got a call the day after the championship game, the SEC game in early December, from one of his coaches, somebody I've been friends with a long time. And he said, you better keep your eye on Nick. He said, he told me the other day he's tired. I think he's going to quit. And I didn't want to go too much on that because you say Nick Saban's going to quit on a program like mine, and you'll have to fight your way to the microphone. So I watched him closely during the trip to Pasadena, and then the next Wednesday, the game was on Monday. On Wednesday, on Get Up, Greenberg goes, could this have been the end of Nick Saban? And I said, I believe Monday in Pasadena was his swan song. And Richard, Marcus Spears was on the set in New York. He came out of his chair and said, that's absurd. There's no, he's never quitting. And Stephen A., before I even looked down at my phone, had said, Paul Feinbaum, you're completely wrong. And at that point, you really don't know what to do because you're having to fight a guy. Marcus played for him, Stephen A. I don't need to tell you. So I kind of laid down on that, but I was watching. I still told my guys. I recorded two different essays on Monday of the week he retired in case he retired. I mean, we were in retirement mode in the event that it happened. You know how it is. You got to, you know, Nick Saban's retired. Let's go to Jeremy Schapp. I mean, you know, 2 seconds later. So when it happened, it was 5:08 on Wednesday. Our group in the control room like yelled that we think Saban. They took me off the air for a second. Just calm down. Let's go to a break. I'm not about to report something like this until I have a chance to take a deep breath. So we took a break. We saw it was Chris Lowe from ESPN. We called Lowe. We said, let him come on the air first. So at that moment, we had another almost 2 hours of the show. We just went wall to wall. We went guest after guest. We had Mandel from The Athletic and Nicole Arabak and Pat Forty. I mean, I just told the guys, I said, just it's an old Hal Raines line from the New York Times. I said, just flood the zone. We're not taking calls. This is too important. I don't need some caller asking me about something other than this. It was a tough call because I knew the callers wanted to get on, but I just felt like this is breaking news. But and that's how we did it. And I've never been prouder of our group. I mean, they handled it. I've been there before in a couple of situations, obviously in the newspaper business and you know, working on 9/11 and all the things that you and others have done. But they were brilliant, it was just one of those rare moments that you have in this field where everybody was spectacular.
I wish you would have just let one Oklahoma City Thunder caller call in just to talk about like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Just change the content up. So one of the things that's interesting to me, again, total outsider here, is that we haven't seen the insanity that usually happens in college football with coaching searches with Kellen DeBoer, who. It seems to me, generally speaking, was hired fairly quickly, came in, like it wasn't the all day Twitter, let's follow the plane kind of stuff. And so how is that plan? Whether he's successful or not is another conversation. But in terms of sort of the media aspect, Paul, of the hiring, how have you seen it from your end?
Yeah, I mean, the name that everyone jumped on, including me, was Dan Lanning.
Right.
Because it just seemed he had worked under Saban. Lanning, I saw him 2 years ago at the draft, and he's I got to play this. He played me a voicemail he saved of Nick Saban offering him a job as a graduate assistant on his staff. I don't know what happened there, but I think it came down to two people: Mike Norvell at Florida State and DeBoer. But it was hard not to hire DeBoer because of his credentials. And yeah, I mean, there's a million reasons why he will be successful, and there's an equal number why he won't. But it was handled very well. The most interesting thing was Saturday at his press conference, right there in the front row, was Nick and Terry Saban. I mean, I don't know that would have made me want to go hide behind the podium.
For a story like this, and again, this is. I mean, even Belichick, I think this is a bigger story just sort of nationally in terms of Saban retiring than Belichick moving on, because Belichick's going to coach again. How long for a show like yours does this continue to be the main topic until people then start to talk about, all right, Paul, what's Georgia's look like next year? You know, what's Mississippi State look like? How long do you think this goes, at least as a main topic of your show?
A very long time.
Wow.
Because there are 1,000 questions. And I mean, the audience, Nick Saban wasn't just a football coach. He was part of the soul of this conference. Nobody's ever been as successful. And I say that because I saw some of the, you know, covering Bryant was traumatic. I was a young guy. He was an old man. By the way, he was only 69 when he was. One thing about Bryant, Richard, not to digress, but his retirement was on the 15th. His last game was on December 29th. He died on January 26th. So you had this compression of time where the death was it was Elvis-like. I mean, I got I'll tell you one quick story about the death. Not that we were here for that, but so I'm covering it, and I'm working for the inferior newspaper. So they just said, just go cover the funeral and then cover the procession back to Birmingham. That's 55 miles. I had to literally break into the procession on the interstate, which went on for a mile and a half with, you know, buses and cars and players, but it was the only way to see it all. And I did it. I admit that now. It took me about 20 years before I told anybody. I literally broke into a funeral procession, but I'll never forget driving down the interstate. There were an estimated 750,000 people, but on this 55 mile, especially as you got to Birmingham where the funeral was going to be. And every on the overpasses, you would see signs, you know, we love you, coach. We miss you. I was talking into a cassette tape recorder, and I found myself talking to myself as I'm driving to keep the notes because I couldn't take notes, and tears are running down my cheek. I say that because this was a little different. This is a man who is 3 years older. And by the way, I'm only 4 years older than Saban. So a lot of things start going through your mind as you're talking about somebody and you're thinking some of the same thoughts. I mean, I'm no longer at the beginning of my career. I think that's not exactly breaking news on this podcast. And it was really, I thought a lot about that. I felt for him. You know, I mean, I think we all know he's probably going into TV. That's a fait accompli, but TV is not, I know, I hate to break it to anyone, but you know, being on TV is not quite being the head coach at Alabama.
So let's get into that. It's a great segue. You're producing the show, Paul. I appreciate that. So I would be absolutely stunned if Nick Saban were not at ESPN in short order. I would probably be stunned, but let's sort of, lowercase s as opposed to capital S if he's not on College Game Day. The one thing about your employer, they've really made no secret about this. Nick Saban is one of the people they have wanted to hire forever. It's sort of a dream hire for them. I think they would love him to be on College Game Day, but they would obviously take him as a studio analyst. They would take him as a game analyst. They take him as the co-host of First Take, quite frankly. I mean, like, although that would be fascinating television. So I think, again, I know you're having to speak of your employer here, but my instincts and everybody else's instincts are correct here, right? Would you not be stunned if Nick is not a colleague of yours at some point? It just makes too much sort of sense.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you a story that has been reported primarily because I told a friend of mine who wrote a book, and you'll recognize the story. But 10 years ago, in May of 2013, I'm going to bring up one of your favorite names here. I had just agreed to the deal with ESPN, but it had not come out yet. And I get a call from Nick Khan.
No, there.
The man. He goes, I'm coming to Alabama next week. If you have time, I was between jobs, so I had time. I'd like you to pick me up at the airport and drive me to Tuscaloosa. I drove, and I'm going to pause for a second. Go back 6 months earlier, and then he knew I knew it. This is 6 months later. I got the story wrong. So I drive him down and he tells me what's going on. I drop him off at the university athletic department where he's met by Jimmy Sexton, who is his equal. And they had dinner that night with Saban and they offered him whatever they offered him. I was not privy to that. So 6 months later, I'm at the Rose Bowl covering my first national championship game. As you may remember, I did game day my first year before the SEC network launched. So Nick said, I want to meet you for lunch at the Langham Hotel, the famous hotel out there where all the big shots stay. I was not there, by the way. I was at a hotel in Glendale. And he tells, when you have lunch with Nick Khan, it's like a scene out of The Godfather. You wait for the person talking to him to exit. So I move out. I don't remember who was in front of me, but the guy leaves and Nick goes, listen, we got a little time here, but at some point, some people might start showing up. I said, whatever. I mean, you know the guy, and I love him to this day. About 30, 40 minutes into lunch, I see John Wildhack, John Skipper, and Nick Saban Saban was out there working. His bowl game had already happened. He was in the Sugar Bowl that year. That was the famous kick six, and they got knocked out of the national championship. And all of a sudden, and Nick kind of looked at me like, it's time for you to leave. You know, so I get up, and I literally watched this. And Saban was considering at that moment, 10 years ago, Richard, he was fed up with football, and he was considering, and that was the genesis of that dance that has been going on in the years that Saban didn't play for the national championship.
Yeah, it's like Khan sort of like the people coming to his table and paying their respects. So, Paul, I think Nick Saban is just very good television, so I think Nick Saban could make it in any forum, but you obviously have a much better sense of Nick Saban than I do. I've never talked to Nick Saban. Would a traveling show be of interest to him? You know, the guy says he's tired, right? And he sort of wants to step away. I'm not saying doing game day is like running a football program. Quite frankly, it's not. But like there is you know what I mean? Like you do got to travel the circuit for however many weeks. Would that be of interest to him, let's say, versus, you know, Nick, come to Charlotte. And just, you know, you do a Saturday all day and then you'd go back home to Alabama.
He's always been fascinated by being part of things. In the million times I've asked him about retirement, he's always said, I've been a part of a team my whole life. So that fills some of that need. And I'll leave it to the critics to decide whether being on the game day set is part of a team or not. The thing that I wonder about is, as you know, Richard, you've been around television. There's a great deal of excitement, but there's mostly boredom waiting to go on. And I wonder how he would handle that. I know in talking to Reese and others, Saban was out there last year for 2 days for the national title game because he was staying in the room next to me. So I was watching him come and go. I mean, I think he would like it to a degree, but I don't know if he wants to, you know, sit around and have somebody say, hey, coach, do you mind? We need you on the 8 o'clock Sports Center. That does not seem like him. I think he would probably, not to be a programmer, enjoy doing games more where, okay, I've got Alabama, Georgia this week. I get to look at film all week. I get to dig down on Friday. I'll talk to the coaches as opposed to game day, which is totally unorthodox at times.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm sure whatever deal Nick signs, he's not gonna be doing SportsCenter 8 o'clock. You know, you could sort of it's like the Troy Aikman deal, basically. You know, you sort of do the games. That'd be interesting though, because if he is interested in doing games, then if you're ESPN, you got to think you know you're not gonna knock out the Fowler Herbstreit team. At the same time, you want Nick Saban on massive games, so in many ways, it's an opportunity for them, but also like. You know, like your bosses get paid for, a bit of a tricky personnel kind of decision.
But I mean, listen, game day is a phenomenal product, draws a lot of people, but you compare that to the biggest games.
Not even close. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I read the same stuff you do. I don't know any more than anybody does, but I'm just giving an opinion on knowing Nick Saban and knowing ESPN. That would be because I mean game day. Yeah, I mean he's going to be great. I mean he's analytical. He's fun. I mean I've seen him be very funny. It's just he's not a patient person. And you know I spent a year on game day. Now again I was the least important person on game day that year. So I basically sat around and watched game day. And then every hour they called me out there for a 2 minute appearance, and that was it. But you know that won't be Saban. There's a lot of is he going to want to hear anybody else's opinion?
Yeah, it's a good question. Have you made the ask to have him on your show? And do you think that will happen eventually?
Not yet. And I'm more out of deference, like give him time to decompress. And again, I don't know what his arrangement is with Pat. So I mean, he may have an exclusive deal.
That's right. Yep.
Really don't know.
Yeah, okay.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
All right, a couple more things here, and this sort of is more broad picture for you. One of the, you know, your the thing with your show is, and rightfully so, your callers have gotten in many ways famous themselves in their own sort of respective areas. And so I wonder how often you have gotten to know some of your well-known and famous callers personally.
A number of them very well. And I think that's something that's more difficult now. When I was in Birmingham, I'm in Charlotte now, I would see them. We would have events. That's how it all happened. We would have a luncheon for Christmas, 16-20 at a restaurant. Then we would have an event before the season that we had maybe. So I got to know a number of them, and you know, we would have them come by, and you may have heard me say this once, but every once in a while you have a terrible tragedy, and I've probably spoken at three or four, given the eulogy at three or four of the funerals, and that has really the most tragic situation. We just lost Phyllis. I know that's somebody.
I want to get to her, but please go on.
But probably the most difficult thing we've ever done. There was a woman named Tammy, who was the Auburn version of Phyllis
from Clanton.
Yeah. And about 5 years ago, she was killed on an interstate with her 3-year-old granddaughter by a truck. And it was the Friday. I was on the way to Athens, Georgia for a game to do our Friday show. And we knew the story, but we had Kirby Smart. We didn't want to upstage the campus. Finally, at 5 o'clock, we announced the death. And Richard, I've been there for all these sad events. It was the saddest day I've ever spent on the air. And then the next week I went back to Alabama for the funeral. And I mean, she was in her 50s, but the as I was giving the eulogy, the 3-year-old right to my left was one of the toughest things I've ever dealt with.
I can only imagine. For the listeners who don't know this, Phyllis Perkins, who Paul referred to before, she was known as, within the college football world, within the Feinberg universe, as Phyllis from
Mulgar.
And her call to Paul in 2014, which is sort of a rant on both Colin Coward as well as basically proclaiming that the Bama dynasty has not died. We will play this. So after I ask Paul this question, we'll get the, so as Paul gives us permission, we'll throw the clip in there. Sure, so you can hear this. But it is, in my opinion, I've said this before, written it at SI, I think it's the greatest sports talk call of all time. She ends it with Bama's dynasty has just begun. Kiss my butt, roll tide. I'm not even going to do it justice with my crappy New York accent. But Paul, the thing that's amazing to me about Phyllis and I-Man and some of these other callers is that they have stood the test of time, which is incredible. It's not a Paul Feinbaum like rant that stands the test of time, but it's a call on your show which does, which I think just sort of speaks to the passion of college football in the South, that these callers became mini celebrities of their own. And some of these calls, like the one I just referenced, that's from 10 years ago. And the viewers, if you put this on YouTube today, I guarantee you'd get hundreds of thousands of views if you just threw it out there.
Hey, Cal Turd, you are just, I don't even have a name for you anymore, except Cal Turd. How dare you say that about Alabama? They lose a game. They lose a game, and they lost it to a good team. The team beat Alabama. But how can you say, after the dynasty took all these years, all these decades, one game is going to mean that Saban's dynasty is over? You're out of your freaking mind, Cal Turd. You need to go back to whatever the hell you was doing before you got on the radio. And how dare you call me out? You call me out, you're going to get me back. You hear me, you punk? How dare you? I don't understand the way you act towards it's Bama. That's what it is. It's Bama. You don't hate any team in this nation except for Bama. And you know why? Because they're better than what you've got. Nick Saban is a better man than you are. You could never coach because you don't have a bit of coaching in your body. You have nothing but to sit there and insult and down and just carry on about everybody that's doing something different than you. You're jealous. That's the bottom line. You're jealous. And Bama's coming back. Bama has not lost. The dynasty is not over. Do you hear me, Cantard? Bama's dynasty has just begun. Kiss my butt. Roll Tide.
Yeah, and to me, that's the most important thing I do. And it was the reason they hired me, although because I know you were there writing about my hire from day one. I'm not sure they'd ever heard any of these people. They just said, okay, we got a talk show that's deep embedded in the South, but
we're a Connecticut company and we want to get bigger in the South.
After a couple of months, I got some looks like, why did we do this? But that's, to me, is what it's about. I feel like we have the most passionate conference in the world with fans, and this is their forum, and they adapted to it. And as much as it was different than what it used to be, they love the idea of being on television and national radio and being heard. And it helps that I have gotten to know them. And Richard, I do feel like I know them. We had a young man that called from Texas the other day. He's going to, he talked about his physical and mental challenges. That's what we do. And the Phyllis call, really embodied that. We've had a couple of other calls. I mean, obviously, whenever I die, it's going to be Paul Feinbaum, who took the call in 2011 from Harvey Updike. He's the guy that poisoned the trees. I know you've referenced it. And my wife actually asked me about it today. We're taping this the day after Martin Luther King Day. We got a call in 2008. That was really one of the most surprising calls. You're half listening, and this, I won't upstage it in case you decide to play it. But the story about that guy, Jay from Huntsville, that you'll appreciate, that call helped a friend of mine worked at the Times. It was a young lady I went to elementary school with. She heard it. She nominated it for an award at Columbia University. And we were among the honorees. So I went to Columbia in May of 2008. And it was a race and diversity seminar of people from the industry. And I could see, I felt bullets aimed at me the entire time. Here's some guy from Birmingham, Alabama. And I tried to endear them, but I finally said, I want to play something for you here at the end. I played that call. And at the beginning of when the guy admitted he was, his father was in the Klan or the Grand, I mean, some of the looks from people at the New York Times and the Boston Globe. And then I just kind of took a deep breath, and finally we got to the end of the call, and I was able to get out of there in one piece.
Jay is next in Huntsville. Hello, Jay.
Hello, Paul.
What's happening?
Oh, not much. Hey, on the conversation Monday, I enjoyed it, by the way.
Thank you.
I got a little tale of my own. Paul, I grew up in Alabama and was raised as a racist.
Were you?
And I was very proud of it. My father was in the KKK. All my uncles were. But in 1967, I joined the Marine Corps. I considered myself strong, brave, and stupid, so I wanted to go to Vietnam. Hmm. And I got my wish. First day there, as big a redneck as I was, I met probably the most militant acting and talking black person that was ever on the face of the earth. Less than an hour after we met, we tried to kill each other. And we tried to kill each other for the next couple of weeks, about every day, till our gunny sergeant took us aside and said, next time that happens, you're going home on a bad conduct discharge. So we put aside our differences and turned out to be fair soldiers. We still had strong animosity. But over the next 20, over the next 2 years, he saved my life a couple of times. I saved his a couple of times. And we didn't, neither one of us want to leave Vietnam. We spent 22 of the 24 months, between 67 and 69, there. 2 months we were being treated in the Philippines. But in 69, we both had to had to leave. And I moved back to Alabama and went to school. He moved back to Detroit and resumed his ways. After I got out of college, as dumb as I was, I managed to get an engineering degree. And I talked to him a few times over those years. We had become, I guess you could call, friends. And he was not having it too good in Detroit. And I said, well, come on down here, and we'll, you can go to work for the same company I am. So he did. And he wound up working for me.
Wow.
And he decided he'd go to school and get his degree, which he did. And he decided he wanted to outdo me, which he always did. He went on and got his master's degree. And I wound up working for him. And 32 years ago, come April 3rd of this year, Paul, I will have been married to his sister for 32 years.
Wow.
We both had...
so now you're working for her.
Yeah. He was the best man at my wedding.
That's incredible. That's an incredible story.
We had two sons apiece. All four of them graduated from University of Alabama. And
anybody ever tell you this would be a good book?
Yeah, probably would be. Nobody would believe it.
this would be a great book and movie.
But we've had a good life, and he lives about three houses down now, and we still try to lie as much as we can about our war exploits. But that just goes to prove, Paul, that anything can happen to a former racist. You never know.
That really is an incredible story. Just an extraordinary piece of history there.
Well, he turned out to be a lot better than I thought he was at first, and I hope I did too.
That's the most impactful call I've ever heard on your show.
I've had at least 15 people from Hollywood over the years call me, ask you to contact that guy, and we never found him.
I know that, which is amazing. Yeah, it's sort of like the white whale to try to find that guy again. On the reverse side, I don't know if this happened this week, Paul, last week, you had a guy call in basically defending Richard Nixon, correct? Like it's Richard Nixon's lawyer, basically.
he's a pretty smart guy. He's in his late 60s, early 70s from St. Louis. And he was defending Nixon. He was attacking the press for the way they treated Nixon. And Richard, there's a million things I know nothing about. Richard Nixon happens to be someone I am a student of. I was in high school. Woodward and Bernstein was my inspiration to go into the journalism. I studied it. I revered those guys. And I probably have read 20 books on Richard Nixon. I watched the Watergate hearings. And so again, you could ask me, give me 12 coaches in the NFL. I might not be able to tell you, but I can go through the Nixon years chapter and verse. And this guy was trying to tell me that the press mistreated Nixon, which I just went crazy over.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, you know, we're now living in an era, many ways, up is down, white is black, et cetera. I appreciated you at least sort of pushing back a little bit on like, listen, man, like, let's get some sense of reality here. You know,
well, the funniest thing is he said Richard E. Nixon. I said, no. And he said he started yelling at me. The guy's got a little bit of, you know, anger management problem. He started screaming. His name is Richard. I said, his name. First of all, I've never heard of Richard E. Nixon. And then, you know, we put up from, whitehouse.gov, he said, well, you're wrong. I said, no, I'm not wrong. He said, the M stands for Emmett. I said, Emmett's spelled with an E. It's not Milhouse is his middle name. So, I mean, it was such a bizarre conversation that it almost felt like a Saturday Night Live skit.
Yeah, maybe he's thinking of Robert E. Lee as opposed to... yeah. All right, let's sort of finish up with this. As we hit the fall for ESPN, Paul, SEC football takes center stage with your company. The CBS deal is over. You make the argument, maybe the greatest media deal of all time, by the way, given what they paid essentially nothing for it in television terms, and were able to roll with that. At the same time, give CBS credit. They absolutely helped push the SEC nationally. But now now the main football package goes to your network. I would think, just to extrapolate it to your own personal situation, is this not great for you? Because you are, I'm not sure there's another ESPN, and maybe Laura Rutledge. Like, there's not many other people who are more identified with ESPN and the SEC than you. And now they're going to be much more invested in SEC football than ever before.
Yeah, I'm not one of these that just push narratives out, but this is probably the upcoming season is the most exciting season I've ever encountered. A couple of reasons. Number one and two, you got Texas and Oklahoma entering the SEC. While this deal takes it and goes into effect, you have the playoff, which is 12 teams versus four. And so everything is different. And yeah, you know, I mean, we are really excited. And I'm glad you mentioned Laura, because she's someone.
Yeah, she's
phenomenal.
You know
how I feel about Laura Rutledge.
Yeah. You can make this happen, but let's tell Jimmy Pitaro and Burke Magnus to like get that signature on the dotted line. Don't be doing anything stupid and letting that negotiation play out too long. You don't want to lose someone that talented.
Listen, she's one of my closest friends, and I think she. I joked with her 7 years ago when she started SEC Nation. I said, Laura, 10 years from now, I'm going to be walking down Fifth Avenue. I'll be retired and, you know, sightseeing, and I'm going to run into you and I'm going to say, hey, Laura, and you're going to look at me like, who are you? Because you're going to be the host of the Today Show. She's mega star. I know you agree.
Yeah. And the irony of that is that New Yorker will be trailing you, Paul, for yet another follow-up story. So everything will...
That is one of my... that's how we got... I think that was our introduction a few years ago.
It was, yeah. No, I mean, you know, you have obviously earned your success, but also in some ways, and you're the first to admit this, which I've always respected from you, in some ways, like, happenstance has to happen sometimes for someone to get a certain break. And for you, that was that story. I think you would concur, right? That story changed your life.
In the summer of 2012, my contract was ending a couple of months later at the local radio station. And I got an email from a guy named Reeves Weidman, who was a blogger from the New Yorker. And we ended up agreeing to meet. And this is the funniest part of the story. I had three, and I'm not going to go through the story again, but there were three people I was meeting with. I had a meeting with a famous agent that I was looking for an agent. I had a meeting with Reeves. But the other meeting was at Sports Illustrated with one of your colleagues. I was doing a column for them at the time. And I remember running into you, and we were yapping about the media. And it was that was the first time I ever met you. But it turned out that I sat down with Reeves at the end. I'd had a terrible meeting with this super agent. You may remember the story. Basically told me, ESPN's not hiring you. You're a local yokel. And I came out of there. My world was upside down. I met Reeves at the Ritz-Carlton down the street from this meeting, which was in the building. What's the Apple, where the Apple store is, and at Central Park South. And he said, I was not even listening because I thought the guy's going to do a blog on me and I really don't care. He said, yeah, you know, I met with David Remnick, and David Remnick believes that we need we haven't had a college football profile in 10 years. And we think you're the guy. And I'm like going, really? Are you serious? He said, we think 6,000-7,000 words. And it came out 6 months later. And the next day, I got a book deal and ESPN brought me in. And okay, I can speak. I don't need to go through the rest.
The rest is history. And again, this is where this, like, sometimes you need happenstance in life. So David Remnick has a big sports background. He's a huge sports fan for a guy who's right, who's into news and China and Russia and all this stuff.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story. In 1983, and I reminded him of this when I met him one day. I said, there were three sports writers in the press box at the old RFK Stadium in D.C. covering a USFL game between the Washington Federals and the Birmingham Stallions. And he was sitting next to me. I mentioned it when I met him, whenever it was, a couple of years ago. He gave me the stats on the game. This is the most famous magazine editor in the world, and he still remembered that.
That's amazing. And so what if that editor of The New Yorker, right, is just someone with a like foreign reporting background or a Washington background? Well, that person's not probably interested in college football in the South. Then that story doesn't exist. So sometimes in life, you need happenstance. And in your case, it's a great example of that. All right, Paul Feinbaum, host of the aptly named The Paul Feinbaum Show, heard on ESPN Radio, SEC Network, Sirius XM Channel 81, Monday through Friday, 3 to 7. Also affiliates around the South, if you're listening to that part of the United States. His show will obviously continue with all sorts of Alabama and Nick Saban stuff. Paul, it's great to catch up with you. I think you literally have had 87 of my colleagues on from The Athletic in the last couple of weeks, so I'm sure they appreciate that. And it's good to catch up with you. I'm sure we will talk again. And I always appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on the Sports Media Podcast.
Thoroughly enjoyed it, Richard. Thank you.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Paul Feinbaum for coming on and giving me some time. Head to the archives. There should be some stuff you like. Also, over the last couple of weeks, Karen Brodkin and Hillary Mandel of Endeavor, if you like behind-the-scenes stuff, they are advisors and help put together massive media deals. They just did the NCAA's deal with ESPN. So if you like the business of the sports media, you'll be interested in that. James Andrew Miller came on to talk about Pat McAfee. We had the producer and director of the College Football National Championship, Bill Bonnell, and Jimmy Platt of ESPN. Hubie Brown was on this podcast not too long ago. Had Ernie Johnson of Inside the NBA, Laura Rutledge. Again, there should be things in the archives you like. If you do like the stuff, please leave us a 5-star review and a note. That's how this podcast continues. No bullshit on that. Want to thank Patrick Antonetti for his work. Thanks everybody at Odyssey for their support, and thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.